Welcome back to another episode of The Adam Paradox. Today we are talking about Frank Turek, who is an American Christian author, public speaker, and radio host. He is the author of two books, Correct, Not Politically Correct, and Stealing from God, and co-author of two more with Norman Geisler, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, and Legislating Morality. He hosts a call-in talk show called Cross-Examined on American Family Radio. His television show, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, airs on the NRB network. Frank Turek used to be a naval flight officer in the U.S. Navy and has a master's degree in public administration from George Washington University and a doctor of ministry in apologetics from Southern Evangelical Seminary. He's also taught classes in leadership and management at George Washington University. He is a Protestant Christian and has delivered talks to numerous churches and universities. In 2004, he co-authored I Don't Have Enough Faith in to Be an Atheist with Norman Geisler. He is an advocate of intelligent design and a critic of evolution. He debated the existence of God with atheist Christopher Hitchens in 2008. So a little bit about his views and what he thinks. In his book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, Turek discusses how we demand truth from doctors, stockbrokers, loved ones, etc., and yet we do not typically demand truth when it comes to morality or religion. He argues that truth is based in correspondence to an absolute reality and is therefore not subjective. It therefore follows that religious truth is also objective, and that to state that there is no truth or that the truth is subjective is self-refuting. After arguing for the objectivity of truth, Turek then argues for the objectivity of knowledge. He asks those who argue that one cannot know anything for sure if they can know that for sure. If that makes sense. I mean, that does seem kind of confusing, but we'll get into that. If they can, then the statement is self-defeating. If they cannot, then it calls the legitimacy of that position into question. Turek concludes by saying that people cannot be skeptics about everything, because then they would have to doubt skepticism. However, the more they doubt skepticism, the more sure they become. He argues that the existence of God implies the existence of miracles. He uses the illustration of a box as a metaphor for the universe. Turek argues that the universe is open and that God, being the creator of the universe, can reach into the universe and perform what one might call miracles. Now, I personally do not believe miracles are a real thing. And the definition of a miracle is very closely related to magic. And only with magic, real magic, at least that happens in our world, and everything that we see are illusions. It still works within physics. It's just mind-boggling that we have managed to trick the eyes or the brain, for instance. But miracles are breaking the laws of physics, are doing things that are unexplainable and completely apart from any physics that we have. Now, we haven't observed any of that. Because everything that has happened, we could probably measure, view, find if we had the right tools. And we don't have that currently to be able to look at those things and say, well, this is exactly what happened and why physics happened this way and the probability of this. And that's why you're the only one that survived on a train wreck of, 250 people. That's a unbreakable scenario there. One of my favorite series, by the way, check out Unbreakable, Split, and Glass. Oh my gosh. Unbreakable was good when it first came out, but then when you got all three of them together, oh boy, that's just like, it's 20 years in the making, and it was like the best thing that I had ever seen in my life. I just love that series. So James McAvoy really definitely deserves a award for that movie. His acting was impeccable. So I have a clip today from Frank Turek talking about answering the atheist. And this is from one of his series where he uses Stephen Hawking as an example. So we're going to go through, and I don't know a ton about Stephen Hawking, but I know enough to know that what he's saying about Stephen Hawking in his book is a little bit out there and not quite accurate. And I know a lot of people take Einstein, deGrasse Tyson, Stephen Hawking, I don't even know if I should really group them together, but Richard Dawkins, all these people, and then they say, this is what they meant. and they only take a little clip out of their books or out of their things, and they don't show you the whole thing. Because if you saw the whole thing, you might have a different opinion than what he's saying. So I did that. I'm going to show the whole clip, the whole video. Well, you're going to hear it. I'm not going to show it. If you were watching, if I had cameras, then you would see it. But no, it's a podcast, so we're going to do it audio.
We said last night that the evidence leaves us with one of the following two options. If the universe had a beginning, it must have had a beginner. What are our two options? We said, number one, either no one created something out of nothing, which is the atheistic view, or someone created something out of nothing, which is the theistic view. Now, my question last night was this: which view is more reasonable? That no one created something out of nothing, or that someone created something out of nothing? It's got to be someone, right? And last night, we said, you can ask who made the someone, but that's certainly more reasonable than no one.
All right, so let's just stop it right there for a second and recap. Either no one created something out of nothing, or someone created something out of nothing, he says. And then goes on to say, it has to be someone. Well, I don't know how you got to that conclusion, because regardless of whether someone did or someone did not, now that you have affirmed in a positive or asserted in a positive, you have to then explain it. In other words, you not only defend it and explain it as of rationality, but you got to prove it. So where is the proof? And a workaround of, well, he's outside of this and outside of that, is only in your thoughts. We don't have any proof that there is a God outside of any reality or universe, or that there is a space outside of space. Now, space is not nothing. That is a common argument that's been going on in science. Space is not nothing. It is something. So it couldn't necessarily be something created from nothing, for space is not nothingness. And this is a common thing that people have a hard time explaining when talking about science, creation, and other things. But just to give it a clear idea of what it is, space is still something. It's not completely nothing. So things could still be created. And I don't think many atheists claim that something was created out of nothing.
No one created something out of nothing, please. Nothing comes from nothing. Nothing ever could, right? Okay, even Julie Andrews knew that. Didn't she sing that in some sort of Sound of Music movie or something? Nothing comes from nothing. So the much more reasonable conclusion is that someone created something out of nothing. And we dealt with the who made God question last night, so I won't go into that. No one made God. We know that. He's the uncaused first cause.
Just to point out another example of what that sounds like is that right there, that no one created God, and we know that. We know that no one created him. How do you know? I mean, these are the kind of questions you need to ask when you're hearing this stuff.
And then we asked, if you want to ask a good question of an atheist, ask, if there is no God, why is there something rather than nothing at all? If there is no God, why does anything exist? If the atheist says, well, the universe has always existed, therefore it doesn't need a cause, you would say what?
That no, it doesn't need a cause. We don't need to have a specific purpose to live out a life that is only to worship a God and get to another place of where there's like no suffering and stuff.
Search. And add Kalam, cosmological argument. Second law, universe expanding, radiation afterglow, great galaxy seeds, Einstein. And then the Kalam cosmological argument confirms that. So the evidence points to the fact that space, matter, and time had a beginning. If that's the case, the cause must be spaceless, timeless, and immaterial. All right? Now, that's what we did last night, and we ended on this slide. We said, how do atheists respond to this evidence? So now we're going to pick up from where we left off last night. Okay, you guys ready to go? Because you're going to say, well, Frank, that just seems so rational here. If your evidence is good, it makes sense that in the beginning, there must have been a beginner. But how do atheists respond to this? How many people have seen this book, The Grand Design by Stephen Hawking? Okay, a few of us have. This book came out about 6 months or so ago, and this book got a lot of press because Stephen Hawking is a very well-respected physicist who has been around a long time, and Hawking is kind of a medical miracle. I don't know if you know much about Hawking, but about 40 or so years ago, he was diagnosed with what is called Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS. And Lou Gehrig's disease normally will kill you in a year or two. Well, here's Hawking, 40 years later, still alive. So he's sort of a medical miracle, brilliant man, and he wrote this book called The Grand Design with another author. Let's take a look at what he says in this book, because it got a lot of attention, and he is a leading atheist, all right? First of all, Hawking agrees that the universe had a beginning, and he cites much of the surge evidence we've already been through. He agrees with what we've been through so far. Secondly, he agrees that our universe appears to be highly fine-tuned for life.
The premise of the fine-tuned universe is a proposition that conditions that allow life in the universe can occur only when certain universal dimensionless physical constants lie within a very narrow range of values, so that if any of several fundamental constants were only slightly different, the universe would be unlikely to be conducive to the establishment and development of matter, astronomical structures, elemental diversity, or life as it is understood. Various possible explanations of ostensible fine-tuning are discussed among philosophers, scientists, theologians, and proponents and detractors of creationism. The fine-tuned universe observation is closely related to, but not exactly synonymous, with the anthropic principle, which is often used as an explanation of apparent fine-tuning. And we've talked about this before in previous podcasts. So in 1913, the chemist Lawrence Joseph Henderson, 1878 to 1942, wrote The Fitness of the Environment, one of the first books to explore concepts of fine-tuning in the universe. Henderson discussed the importance of water and the environment with respect to living things, pointing out that life depends entirely on the very specific environmental conditions on Earth, especially with regard to the prevalence and properties of water. In 1861, physicist Robert H. Dick claimed that certain forces in physics, such as gravity and electromagnetism, must be perfectly fine-tuned for life to exist anywhere in the universe. You'll hear this later in the clip where he discusses magnetism and gravity and stuff, and it's just I couldn't help but get upset at this video. I gotta be honest. This guy just is not using any real evidence that we have today. Because if he did and he actually understood what science was, he wouldn't be using these claims. John Griffin and Martin Rees wrote a detailed history and defense of the fine-tuning argument in their book Cosmic Coincidences in 1889. According to Gibbon and Rees, the conditions in our universe really do seem to be uniquely suitable for life forms like ourselves, and perhaps even any form of organic complexity. But the question remains, is the universe tailor-made for man? The premise of the fine-tuned universe assertion is that small change in several of the dimensionless physical constants would make the universe radically different. As Stephen Hawking noted, the laws of science as we know them at present contain many fundamental numbers like the size of the electric charge of the electron and the ratio of the masses of the proton and the electron. The remarkable fact is that the values of those numbers seem to have been very finely tuned and adjusted to make possible the development of life. If, for example, the strong nuclear force were 2% stronger, then it is the Compley constant representing its strength were 2% larger, while the other constants were left unchanged. Diprotons would be stable, according to physicist Paul Davies. Hydrogen would fuse into them instead of deuterium and helium. This would drastically alter the physics of stars and presumably preclude the existence of life similar to what we observe on Earth. The existence of the diproton would short-circuit the slow fusion of hydrogen into deuterium. Hydrogen would fuse so easily that it is likely that all the universe's hydrogen would be consumed in the first few minutes after the Big Bang. This diproton argument is disputed by other physicists who calculate that as long as the increase in strength is less than 50%, stellar fusion could occur despite the existence of stable diprotons. So this makes a lot of sense when you hear both sides going back and forth. So I can see where Frank Turek gets his opinion from. And I'm not saying he's wrong necessarily. However, I don't think he's considering the many other factors that go into play when discussing the fine-tuned universe. He still immediately jumps and concludes to a god or a creator. However, I don't know that we have the answer. I don't think this Bible and this God is the one. How do you have 4,000 other different religions and different gods and rule all them out but not this one. Because if you apply the same methods that you ruled out the other ones, surely this one would be among them. Considering how it's written and how it's described. And we've seen this before. It's not the first time we've seen this. You've seen Hercules, for instance. Hercules came after Jesus in the timeline. And he was the savior with godlike abilities and powers. And we know he's a myth. But we don't know Jesus is a myth. Yet everyone presumes he's real. And he was God who came to earth as himself, sacrificed himself to forgive everybody of, you know, sins and punishment that he put on everybody in the first place. When in realistic, it just doesn't work. Because he could just say, I forgive you, and be done and over it if that was it. And not only that, if he was real, he'd give us some unrefutable information and signs. He wouldn't be messing around and hiding behind any curtain, you know, that kind of thing. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the Hoyle state, an older example. The third lowest energy state of the carbon-12 nucleus with an energy of 7.656 MeV above the ground level. According to one calculation, if the state's energy level was lower than 7.3 or greater than 7.9 MeV, an insufficient carbon would exist to support life. Furthermore, to explain the universe's abundance of carbon, the Hoyle state must be further tuned to a value between 7.596 and 7.716. That's only like a difference of 2.2 there. That's not very much. Focusing on the underlying fundamental constants that give rise to various energy levels concludes that the strong force must be tuned to a precision of at least 0.5% and the electromagnetic force to a precision of at least 4% to prevent either carbon production or oxygen production from dropping significantly. Now, here's the thing. We look at this at such a small level because we're so big, and it seems like there's this irreducible complexity that everything is fine-tuned. Yet we don't, if we look at, like, say, a piece of bread that begins to mold and create a fungus and go into, like, full shrooms and whatnot, we don't question how fine-tuned that was or the conditions were in order to have created it, how hard it must have been for bacteria or for any organism to create that mold in order to, like, consume the material. It is fine-tuned in a sense, but it's not so questionable as to how could this even have happened. I mean, we're here. So here's the thing. I think the universe has always existed. I think it's always been around, and that is how energy tends to work. So it's very easy to think that we are in a position that right now has been long enough to sustain life, and if we go on a higher scale of everything, that it becomes actually possible. Now, then when you also consider that time and space are the same thing, then it gets very interesting, because time is then subjective to where we are in space. In other words, not just as a planet, but as a person. And there's a TED Talk that shows this and shows how someone can actually, you can actually see someone going back and forth through time, the difference in experience and everything. So, and that's just relative to movement. But that, as it is currently where we sit on the fine-tuned universe.
And we're going to talk more about the fine-tuning here in a few minutes. I mentioned a little bit of it when we talked about the G in SURGE, the Great Galaxy Seeds. But Hawking's already agreeing with that. Now let's go into the book. And by the way, last night we had a question from a young lady in the back. She was holding her little baby, you remember, on this book. So let's go through this book in a little bit more detail. Here are some philosophical problems with the book. Here's what Hawking says. And before I put that up here, let me point this. One thing I like about Hawking is that he tells you exactly where he's coming from. He does not beat around the bush. He just says it in plain English. Here's what he says on page 34. This book is rooted in the concept of scientific determinism, which implies that there are no miracles or exceptions to the laws of nature. Now, what is scientific determinism? The lady here last night stated it very well. Hawking was saying, that every cause in the world, in the universe, is the product of a prior natural event. So there are no miracles. There are no exceptions to this. Everything is just a product of a previous natural event. Okay, that's called scientific determinism. What does that imply? First of all, this is a philosophical assertion, not a scientific conclusion. It begs the question in favor of atheism. Do you see that this is a philosophical conclusion he makes here? He can't learn this by doing some sort of experiment. This is not a scientific conclusion. This is a philosophical presupposition. He says scientific determinism is true, therefore there are no miracles, therefore atheism is true. How does he know this? Because he said so.
Objection, Your Honor, leading the witness. Scientific determinism is something that will happen in the future that can be predicted. Since many limitations on predictability are known, most people who argue for determinism do not argue in favor of a strong version of scientific determinism. And if we look at the definition of determinism, it's a philosophy also called necessitarianism, the philosophical doctrine that all events, including human actions and choices, are fully determined by preceding events and states of affairs. And so that freedom of choice is illusory. The scientific doctrine that all occurrences in nature take place in accordance with natural laws. And for general physics, the principle in classical mechanics that values of dynamic variables of a system and of the forces acting on the system at a given time completely determine the values of the variables at any later time. What this means is that it's like a doctrine that all facts and events exemplify natural laws. And that's determinism, okay? So when we look at scientific determinism, it means that we are attempting to use all the logic of what we observe, and that's it. So everything that we conclude or that we presume or that we make a presupposition about is based on scientific evidence and not about, you know, superstitious belief or any other workaround that we don't necessarily have evidence for. Now, a rational thought can be made for some of these things and explained and everything, but that doesn't make it true. It doesn't make anything that we're discussing legitimate. And that's where science is taking a huge leap over religion and why religion's down and atheism is up to 30% now of the population. And most other countries are actually still atheist. You know, there's very few that are actually highly religious. And you know what? In the highly religious areas, there's a lot of war and killing. And it's because people believe things that are not based. It's not based on anything. It's not proven. And you get very upset when you're trying to defend these things without actual evidence. You don't do that when you have the actual evidence. You just got to explain it more. But all right, let's continue on anyways, you know, because it's atheism that he's giving answers to that. Yeah.
That's it. I just said so. It's an assertion. There's no evidence for this. This is just a philosophical assertion. That's why I said last night, science doesn't say anything, scientists do.
And this is the danger of religions, because he's now telling you wrong information. It's completely wrong. It's not that science is making assertions or science doesn't explain things and scientists do. That's what you're doing. So you're creating a bias that other people are doing what you're doing because that's what you do. That's what you think. That's the way you think. And you think others think like you do. And that's not true at all, because science doesn't discriminate. It doesn't use personal belief or bias. In other words, it does discriminate. Correction. It does discriminate because it doesn't use your bias. It doesn't use your beliefs. It is based on a system of people doing peer reviews that eventually the information has to go through a graduation process. And if it can't be falsified, then it comes out basically as the best information we have today. And scientists are pretty good at accepting that as being, you know, current evidence and everything. We're comfortable with the unknowns and uncertainties. You, sir, are not. And if you were any kind of doctor in philosophy or any kind of doctor in science or any kind of real doctor with a real doctorate from a accredited university, you would know that the scientific process is a very reliable one in the sense that it uses different methods to test whether something is real or legitimate or not. In other words, I can falsify your claim of a god or a creator simply by going, there's no proof. You can't tell me it's anything different or separate apart from the mind or thought. And that's what we're trying to ask for. It's not very complicated. It's not a war against atheism and Christianity or any other religion. It's just, that's it. Where's the evidence?
And if you're not good at philosophy, you may come up with bad scientific conclusions. And this book that Hawking has written is just loaded with philosophical presuppositions that he can't prove. Atheistic philosophical presuppositions. Suppose some Christian said, miracles do occur. In fact, they happen all the time. And then you ask the Christian why, and he just says, because I said so.
Yeah, the Christian will often ask why and say, because I said so, because that's what they do. There's nothing else there. Now, atheism is not, he's making it sound like a religion here, and atheism is not a religion, it's not a belief system. It's simply going, there's no evidence to believe in a God. Now, try to not believe in something that you know exists. Go ahead and don't believe in a car. Because you know a car does exist. However, I mean, this is going to be a simple analogy, but you don't need to believe that a car does once you know it does exist. It's no longer believing. It's no longer faith. You now know it exists, and therefore it's knowledge.
You'd say, well, what do you mean? Because that's an assertion. I need some evidence. He has no evidence for this. This is just what he says.
And once again, we actually know some of what we know based on tests and other things. It's not just an assertion of, well, hey, God's real because unicorns are real. That's an assertion. God is real because of the stars. That's an assertion. We have no evidence among any of these things that it points or leads to a God. In other words, show me the DNA or a fingerprint that God did it. You know what I mean? That's kind of what it's saying.
Secondly, this also means that Hawking's thoughts in this book are determined. In other words, we have no reason to believe they are true. If every effect in the universe is a product of a previous natural cause, then so are his thoughts. His thoughts are the product of a previous natural cause, which means we have no free will, which means he's not really reasoning. What's he doing? He's simply a product of previous natural causes. He doesn't have free will. He's not really thinking. These thoughts are just coming to him because of some brain chemistry going on here. He's just molecules in motion. If that's the case, why should we believe what he says?
And you nailed it. Okay, so the brain does control a lot of what we think and how we behave and how we act. And that's a chemical composition that reacts to stimuli. It also puts memories together, and that's what develops in our brain using proteins and other things. And if without these memories, without these abilities to determine our past, we would not have the best intellect of what we should do now or in the future. We wouldn't even be comprehensive of who we love or why or what we believe in the first place. So there is something there, and it's a highly mechanical system, in other words, that has allowed us to be able to be comprehensive, aware, and conscious. However, there are still so many things we're not aware of. Look up, I think it's like 100 of the most common biases online. You can look up any of these and find tons of them. There's many things that we believe that we don't realize we believe them. Many things that are considered biases. Here, let me see if I can pull this up. All right, so here's a list of about 12 of these different biases that you can find, and I'll just go through a couple of them. I don't think I'm going to go through a lot of them. So confirmation bias. We love to agree with people who agree with us. It's why we only visit websites that express our political opinions, and why we most mostly hang around people who hold similar views and tastes. We tend to be put off by individuals, groups, and news sources that make us feel uncomfortable or insecure about our views. What the behavioral psychologist B.F. Skinner called cognitive dissonance. I've read much of B.F. Skinner books. If you ever get a chance, read his books. Wow. They're just, I mean, it's not like anything astronomical or, you know, amazing like in that sense, but it's just so interesting. If you like interesting books, that's one to check out. It's this preferential mode of behavior that leads to the confirmation bias, the often unconscious act of referencing only those perspectives that fuel our pre-existing views, while at the same time ignoring or dismissing opinions, no matter how valid, that threaten our worldview. And paradoxically, the internet has only made this tendency even worse. So that is that's a bias. And you know what? One of the things that I do that a lot of people question is, why do I talk to people that believe in Christ and God when I don't myself? Why bother at all? So I get this often. If I'm not a believer, why do I hang around and try to, you know, they say I try to convince them not to be a believer. And that's not at all what I do. I ask them to ask the questions. But also, they press against what I believe. So if I'm going to figure out if what I believe or what I think or anything that I'm pursuing is to be falsified in any way, shape, or form, the scientific method, then who better to talk to than the people that believe the opposite of what you do, the ones that can help falsify your thoughts and beliefs. Now, what that means is I'm always asking for evidence. What do you have to prove it? And then they come back and say, well, we have the Bible or we have this. And I go, okay, so where's the physical evidence that I can measure, test, and observe? Well, there isn't any. And therefore, I have at least confirmed that I am still not in the wrong. In other words, I know I'm as right as or correct as far as I can be at the current moment until such evidence comes forward. Now, that doesn't mean I'm going to change my view, suddenly become a believer and then follow all their rules and their book and everything. It just means that I might be wrong and there might actually be something there. But until that comes forward, we don't know. So that's kind of what that is. There's a gambler's fallacy. It's called a fallacy, but it's more a glitch in our thinking. We tend to put a tremendous amount of weight on previous events, believing that they'll somehow influence our future outcomes. Now, this is very true when I go through developmental psychology and in and you kind of experience and observe how people react based on their previous experiences. That's why we have PTSD and other mental disorders that kind of, you know, go together with that. One of the things, though, that make it all kind of come together is that based on how you're raised, based on how you're treated, is often how you're going to react in future situations. If you were abused, you're going to likely be more secluded or timid around people that are very abusive or strong in nature. And usually the people that were abused or bullies are those same people. And it just kind of goes in a circle. So yeah, our past events do have some sort of influence on our current, you know, behaviors and future outcome. But let's see. So the classic example is the coin tossing. After flipping heads, say, 5 consecutive times, our inclination is to predict an increase in likelihood that the next coin toss will be tails. Then the odds must certainly be in the favor of heads. But in reality, the odds are still 50-50. As statisticians say, the outcomes in different tosses are statistically independent and the probability of any outcome is still 50%, which is true. I mean, it's 50%. It's going to land heads or tails, but the difference in outcome is based on the force, wind, all sorts of other variables. Post-purchase rationalization. Remember that time you bought something totally unnecessary, faulty, or overly expensive? And then you rationalize the purchase to such an extent that you convince yourself it was a great idea all along. Yeah, that's post-purchase rationalization in action, a kind of built-in mechanism that makes us feel better after we make crappy decisions, especially at the cash register. or also known as buyer's Stockholm syndrome. It's a way of subconsciously justifying our purchases, especially expensive ones. Social psychologists say it stems from the principle of commitment, our psychological desire to stay consistent and avoid a state of cognitive dissonance. You know, I can agree with that quite wholeheartedly. status quo bias. We humans tend to be apprehensive of change, which often leads us to make choices that guarantee that things remain the same. And then I'm really stuck in that one right now. And I wouldn't even consider I'm being biased, but I'm considering, do I continue on with a doctorate or do I take a break? And that's kind of what my struggle is currently right now. And it's just, it's like 4 or 5 years. It's just a long process. So, I mean, I'm currently like in the beginning of that. So I don't know what I do or what I continue with. And it's a lot of money too. Or do I just stay where I am? I mean, the master's level is still really high. It's a terminal degree, but you know, a doctorate would also be kind of nice as well. Anyways, okay, enough about me. Negativity bias. People tend to pay more attention to bad news. This one is very true, and it's not just because we're morbid. Social scientists theorize that it's on account of our selective attention and that given the choice, we perceive negative news as being more important or profound. We also tend to give more credibility to bad news, perhaps because we're suspicious or bored of proclamations to the contrary. More evolutionarily, heeding bad news may be more adaptive than ignoring good news. Today, we run the risk of dwelling on negativity at the expense of genuinely good news. Steven Pinker, in his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, argues that crime, violence, war, and other injustices are steadily declining, yet most people would argue that things are getting worse. What is a perfect example of the negativity bias at work? Or the bandwagon effect. Okay, I think this is going to be my last one because, this one and then projection bias. These are good. Though we're often unconscious of it, we love to go with the flow of the crowd. When the masses start to pick a winner or a favorite, that's when our individualized brains start to shut down and enter into a kind of groupthink or hive mind mentality. But it doesn't have to be a large crowd or the whims of an entire nation. It can include small groups like a family or even a small group of office coworkers. The bandwagon effect is often what causes behavior, social norms, and memes to propagate among groups of individuals, regardless of the evidence or motives in support. This is why opinion polls are often maligned, as they can steer the perspectives of individuals accordingly. Much of this bias has to do with our built-in desire to fit in and conform, as famously demonstrated by Ash conformity experiments. All right, last one, projection bias. As individuals trapped inside our own minds 24/7, it's often difficult for us to project outside the bounds of our own consciousness and preferences. We tend to assume that most people think just like us. This is what I was explaining earlier. With Frank Turek about how he thinks that everyone else are atheists think like he does, that you must believe in something. It's a very poor philosophy for someone to be believing in philosophy to limit themselves to. Though there may be no justification for it, this cognitive shortcoming often leads to a related effect known as the false consensus bias, where we tend to believe that people not only think like us, but that they also agree with us. It's a bias where we overestimate how typical and normal we are, and assume that a consensus exists on matters when there may be none. Moreover, it can also create the effect where the members of a radical or fringe group assume that more people on the outside agree with them than is the case, or the exaggerated confidence one has when predicting the winner of an election or sports match.
This is what some might say a universal acid that burns everything up. It burns its own theory up. To say determinism is true is to say, well, how did I come to the conclusion that determinism is true? Because I had a previous natural cause it in my mind. Well, how would I know then what I'm really believing is true then? You wouldn't. So he's just given up the entire show here by saying this. How can you be a scientist? How can you discover truth if this is the case? You can't. In fact, he says it on page 32. Free will is just an illusion. If free will is just an illusion, then so are his thoughts in this book, aren't they? This is a dream, basically. Well, why should we believe it then? Do you see why you can't do science unless you know philosophy? These are all philosophical assertions, and if you don't pick them out, you're going to be, wow, how do I deal with Hawking when he gets to the end and he says, there's no God? If you don't know philosophy, you won't be able to pick this out. Now he says that he asks a question here, and you're not going to believe, well, maybe you will believe it after what I just said, but check out this question that Stephen Hawking, the great physicist, asked. He says, do we really have reason to believe that an objective reality exists? What do physicists do? They observe objective reality, theoretically, and they discover what happens in the physical world, the objective physical world, right? Hawking is asking the question, do we even have any reason to believe that this physical objective reality exists? You know what he says? What do you think he says? He says no. That's right. He says no, there is no model independent concept of reality. That's what he says. Now go back to what we talked about last night, the Roadrunner tactic, applying a claim to itself. If you apply that claim to itself, what do you get? You see, this is self-defeating. Is that concept of reality objective? Is it? It defeats itself. This also makes science impossible. Because if there is no objective reality, what is the scientist trying to observe? See, science is a search for causes. And if there is no objective reality, or let me put it this way, science is a search for causes in objective reality. If there is no objective reality, what are we looking for? And if everything in our mind is the product of a previous natural cause, are we even reasoning or are we just reacting?
You know, for a doctor, you ask very simple, easy questions that I hear from people that aren't even at your level of intelligence, if we can say that. Based on your credentials, sure, you have some sort of intelligence. Yeah, we are actually reacting most of the time, and we are conscious of things, and we try to make our best informed decisions as we can possible, mostly out of self-preservation. It's a chemical process in which we get that gut feeling and go, I don't know if I should do that, or man, I don't know how I feel about that. Now, for instance, I would continue on with my doctorate without even a hesitation, because I would go, well, I don't feel bad about it. Why not? Although I also wouldn't be in the same position. So kind of like your argument of self-defeating, that's kind of what that's like. However, we do know scientifically an objective reality. Okay, there is an objective reality and we all have a different perception of it. That's where we have a personal reality and we conflict those two things. So what you asserted was actually false and was really just an assertion of your own, trying to make it sound like it's absurd for the other opposing assertion. Because you believe in philosophy, not science. But if you put both of those together, you would actually have more of a realistic approach to reality than anyone else. So you think that he's not considering philosophy when it's a philosophy of science in general?
We're just chemicals. We're just molecules in motion. Remember we talked about this last night? Remember Kant said you can't know the real world? And we said the answer to that is, well, then how do you know that about the real world? Well, you might as well just put Hawking in Kant's chair, because this is what Hawking's buying into. He's buying into Kant. That's why I said last night, if you can't understand Immanuel Kant, you can't understand modern philosophy, and now you can't understand Hawking unless you understand Kant. He's given up objective reality in order to say that there is no God, basically. That's what he gets to. That's where he's heading with this. I know this is kind of hard to believe when you think about it, but this is what a world-renowned physicist is saying.
Actually, it's not what he's saying. And do you always get high-pitched when you lie? What Stephen Hawking is saying is that there is no evidence through the observations that we have made in science that conclude or lead to a God creating it. That's not like a thing you have to believe or not. That is an objective part of reality. If there was a God in our laws of physics and logic, and he interacted with our laws of physics and logic, then by those laws of physics and logic, there has to be an equal or opposite reaction. In other words, there would have to be a sign of it. Fine-tuning is not technically a sign of anything. If you hold a ball in your hand, are you finely tuning the holding of that ball for an eternity or for a long period of time to create life? Not likely. And I don't mean that as because there's gravity and all that stuff. Anyways, it's just an example. But this is the danger, that when you're listening to these things and they're making assertions and claims, you have to be skeptic enough to question, is this really what Stephen Hawking was talking about? Is this really what he believed in? Is this what he meant? And so far, all we know is, no, that's not what it is, because I just told you what it was. So look it up. Look up Stephen Hawking. He's not saying that because of all this, that in this non-objective reality, that means there's no God. We're not in the Matrix, for instance. We have no evidence to suggest we're in the Matrix. We could be. It's a very plausible, idea. But again, it's only an idea. It doesn't mean it's real. Doesn't mean anything. We have no evidence for it. And that's kind of the same thing, again, that we look at when there is an objective reality. It's just not this or the other. There's perceptions involved. So come on, Mr. Philosophy, doctor, whatever. Figure this out, man.
This is why Einstein said many years ago, he said, the man of science is a poor philosopher. The man of science is a poor philosopher.
Yes, because philosophy relies on belief and interpretation of what you think could be a possibility or way of living or anything. That's what's philosophical. And science is kind of like that. But no, science still goes hand in hand with philosophy. There's still a true philosophy and there's a false one. You can make false claims in philosophy and you can make true claims in philosophy. So there's bad. It's almost like the dark arts versus Harry Potter, whatever his was. I mean, it does exist. It just...
Hawking is a very poor philosopher. He's making elementary mistakes in logic and making assertions that he can't prove in order to get to the conclusion he wants.
Very interesting you should say that. That he's making assertions to get the conclusion he wants. Now, in psychology, we'd say that's projection. That, in fact, you are making assertions to feed your... outcome or whatever of a God without any proof. None, not a single damn thing. The Bible is completely unproven. There's not one thing that's true about it. Yeah, you can have a location. Sure. Yeah, sure. There is archaeological, locations found and whatnot. That doesn't prove anything. Just because there's New York doesn't mean there's a Spider-Man. Yeah, so philosophy might be more faulty than you actually think.
But there's more, as you might imagine. Those are just the philosophical problems. What are the scientific problems in the book? Well, let's take a look. Here's what he says on page 9. Multiple universes arise naturally from physical laws. And then he goes on to say, because there is a law like gravity, the universe can and will create itself out of nothing. Okay, first of all, let's deal with the first, multiple universes. How do scientists, or atheists I should say, deal with the fact that the universe seems to be so precisely fine-tuned that there must be a designer out there? How do they deal with that from an atheistic perspective? You know what their answer is? Their answer is, we just happen to be in the universe that appears designed. Because you see, there are many universes out there, multiple universes out there, and we're just lucky to be in the one that looks designed, even though it really isn't.
I don't know many atheists that actually think that, okay? I don't know. I haven't heard anybody that said, we just happen to be lucky here. I don't think luck had anything to do with it. I think it was millions of years of adaptation and survival and that we are in the right place and right time. There's no luck or random chance that it was like, that planet. It just happened to be the planet that we're on. And that's not chance. I mean, sure, you can say that, but I mean, that's not what it is. It's just we are here because we existed over a long period of time. There's no other factors in that. So, yeah, I don't believe in that statement at all.
Now, is there any evidence for this? No. The only universe we know about is the one we're in, right? There's no evidence for it. This is just what is known as a metaphysical speculation about ultimate reality, which Hawking has just said doesn't exist anyway. But you see, we get into these contradictions by even trying to talk about what these people believe. But they're trying to avoid a designer. So he says multiple universes arise naturally from physical laws. And he says, gravity will create us.
Oh, the bit about gravity. Okay, so here's a question for you, Dr. Turek. Let's say that there is another planet with the same amount of life and everything on it, and we have the one true God. Okay? So does this God perform miracles on that planet as well? Are they also the chosen Israelites and the chosen people? What happens to your Bible if it corrupts because of this newfound information that there could be life on another planet, which your Bible didn't even believe that others existed? They just thought the stars was a blanket that gets put over the earth or the flat surface or something and creates a dome and whatnot. That's what they thought it was. They also thought the sun and moon were gods. They thought a volcano was a god. Your Yahweh, for instance, was a volcano. But what happens, Mr. Philosopher? What happens when you go and you find life on another planet? Because we have been finding other planets with water and greenery on it. Mars has water on it. That means that at one time it could have been in our solar system, or our ring, our path and trajectory of Earth, and then split off. So what about that? And what happens here is gravity takes in all these particles and all these rocks and everything and collides and all these minerals, and then it starts creating, it was like a, we were like hell on earth. It was like volcano and ash, and it formed into this crust, and then eventually the H2O molecules formed from, I think it was hydrogen and carbon, or is it nitrogen and carbon? I can't remember. Anyways, and then we started to get water and everything, and then as because of the hot and colds and everything, then life started to form. And now this life could have been on Mars prior. We could all be descendants of Martians. That's a very hypothetical theory, but I mean it's possible. Like we're finding life on Mars, and we could find a connection that our DNA or molecules are on Mars as well. So how's that possible? If this Earth was created and put in the position of fine-tuning just exactly the way it was. So I think there's something you're missing, and I think there is something that does explain the fine-tuning of the Earth or the universe, but I don't necessarily think that a creator had to also do it to create fine-tuning. And I could probably find many demonstrations of that, but that's just an example for now.
Or did create us. Now, what's the problem with this? First of all physical laws, including gravity, had a beginning and therefore need a cause. Remember, we pointed this out already. Space, matter, and time had a beginning. So there was no gravity to create anything. Gravity was created. If gravity was created, then gravity couldn't create us. And one wonders how gravity could create us anyway. Gravity is an impersonal force. Like, for example, when I drop this remote and it goes to the floor, gravity just does that. It's not thinking, if he drops that one more time, I'm not gonna pull that to the ground, right? It's an impersonal force, does the same thing over and over again. It's not thinking, it's not making decisions, it just does the same thing over. It's an impersonal force.
I'm not sure what science you know, but gravity, without it, we wouldn't have the density structures that we have. We would be likely blobs, and we would not even have developed into humans or upright hominids, you ignorant dumbass. So here's the thing. Gravity is a force that's it exists in space, and it pulls everything together and is what allowed everything to sort of mix together and create carbon life forms. Learn some basic science.
Persons can make choices, and that's one reason we know that the beginner was personal, because only persons can choose to create, but impersonal forces make no choices. They just do the same thing over and over again. So to go from a state of non-existence to a state of creation, you have to make a choice.
Once again, you're on a projection bias. You're assuming that the creator had to make a choice that created everything, and that's not true. Because you don't have to make a choice to create anything. Not only that, we don't have the ability, if we're going to use this whole analogy and circle it around a bit. This is the paradox anyways, the podcast of paradoxical things. If you were to create something, you would also have to be able to create the molecules and or how they act and react in situations. Without prior knowledge of this, there is no knowledge of it to begin with. So how do you create that? How does a creator suddenly go from nothing to something? In other words, nothing of thought. And I mean, there's no previous experience. So unless there is a multiverse, in other words, a previous universe to this one, this is where that theory comes in, even in religion. Yes, gotcha. So if there was no previous experience, if there was no, there'd be no reason for God to assume that they needed somebody else to talk to, that he needed, he would have to have looked at himself and gone, oh boy, I got hands and arms and legs and, gosh, I must be created in an image. I mean, was he not a follower first? How did he suddenly know that he needed to create everybody in a certain way? If there's no previous experience to base that on. Does that mean he tried many, many different ways and they just all failed? And so he said, scrap it. I'll just keep flooding the damn earth. No, that means that what we observe over millions of years is in complete contradiction to a creator. And if there was one, and Albert Einstein thought of a pantheistic God, he's the most laziest one there is to just initiate the Big Bang. And that's it. I don't presume that there is a God, not a creator one, not like this, not at least one of the universe. And if there is one that's a God, let's determine, does he have the abilities of a God, or is he just a being that has the ability to do things that we do not due to evolution or due to other things? You ever watch Dragon Ball Z? There's a cat-like God character who can do things way more powerful than most others in the universe. And then you got Goku that comes in and defies all these laws of a Saiyan and like becomes like this godlike Saiyan, goes to God mode and all these other things. Like there's these probabilities, but he's still just a man. And he didn't create anything. He destroyed a lot of stuff. But I mean, just to put in perspective that a God who created something, who never had any previous experience or reason to create something in the first place, couldn't have done it with such an absolute defined method that we have, that the Bible describes. It just doesn't make sense.
So the cause originally of the universe must be personal. Can't be gravity. Gravity was created anyway, all right? Also, a quantum vacuum is not nothing. Non-being, it needs a cause. Now you're probably going, what's a quantum vacuum? Hawking gets into this idea that at the quantum level, that's the very small level, subatomic particles, it might be the case that things pop into existence out of nothing. Well, if that's the case, maybe the whole universe popped into existence out of nothing.
And that's the argument of something from nothing, as nothing is not nothingness. In other words, when you have space, something is still there. In space, like it's, if you had a box and there's nothing in it, that is space. There's still something in there, though. We just don't know what space is.
Because in a quantum vacuum, it's possible that things can pop into existence out of nothing. At least that's one interpretation of the quantum level. The real answer to that, of course, is that's only one interpretation of the quantum level. There are at least 10 different interpretations, and nobody knows which one is right. But a quantum vacuum is not nothing. It's not non-being. Even if in a quantum vacuum particles come into existence without a cause, at least a cause we can identify, the question is, what created the quantum vacuum? Where did that come from? Hawking has no answer for that.
All right, so we don't really know all too much about this, but let's put this in a perspective. If God existed, then he had to exist in space and time. So space would have already had to been created prior to God existing. Otherwise, he couldn't have existed, because that goes against the logic and fallacies of space. And time had to have a place to put time in there. Now, this is something that the Bible actually got right. Time, it was time, space, and something else. I can't remember. But those three things had to be in place. The Trinity, in other words. So I think that's more just luck, to be honest, because they didn't have any actual science that they were basing it on. It was just philosophical. So I'm sure anyone could have thought it up, right? It's not any special information. Now, when you don't consider these things and think outside the box, for instance, which you still got to have a box to think within, you just have a smaller box in front of you, inside a bigger box. That's really all that means. You're not really outside the box entirely. And if you try to imagine that, it just doesn't work because technically there's still another box. Maybe you just can't see the walls. That's kind of the fallacy that you're in, sir. That I know that's confusing, but that's what it is.
Finally, the speculative multiple universes, even if they exist, need a cause. Yesterday I gave a quote early on when we were talking about the cosmological argument. It was from a cosmologist called Alexander Vilenkin, a Russian cosmologist, and he said this, that scientists now must deal with the fact that the universe had a beginning. I'm paraphrasing, but that's the short end of his quote. And this guy, Vilenkin, is a believer in the multiverse, that there are many universes out there. But even Vilenkin admits, he said, even if there are all these other universes out there, the whole show, all the universes together need a cause. They had to have a beginning.
All right, so now I'm confused. Did they have to have a beginning or did they have to have a cause? I don't think either had to have anything. I think the cause or whatever is a need of humans to believe that there is a cause for something, to have purpose. Dogs have the same desire. They desire to have a purpose. They love to work. It's weird. But anyways, they do. And I think that's a trait of adaptation that we observed over a long period of time. We have to do something to feel worth anything. And that's because we have a chemical release of dopamine that gives us a high that makes us feel good and rewarded when we do things and work hard for things. So I don't think the universe had to have a cause. I think if anything, it's just what it is. So to imply anything else is really just adding to assumption that you can't prove that there had to have been cause in the first place. So what's your rationale for that? Can you rationalize why we had to have one? I kind of think it's easier to rationalize why there has to be a limit on anything. And I don't mean like to necessarily give an answer why to rationalize on it, but I mean like to try to explain why there should be a rationalization of why not to do something rather than why to do something. I think that's also what limits us from pursuing what it is we want to pursue in the future. We're too worried about what the cause is or about what the limits are or about rather than just going through with it. We're worried about the cause. And I just don't think there is one for the universe. I think we are just here to exist and do what we do and justify why we don't do something. But we shouldn't limit ourselves, right?
So even one of the biggest proponents of the multiverse says, at the end of the day, you ultimately have to get back to a beginning of the whole thing. So even if he's right about multi-universes, it doesn't help them avoid a beginner. Okay, so that's Stephen Hawking. You don't need to be afraid of Stephen Hawking if you just know a little logic and a little philosophy and some science here too, because he gets a lot of that wrong as well, unfortunately.
Oh, really? And I suppose you're an authority on that, you know, given that you don't have a doctorate from any regionally or nationally accredited university of science.
Oh, if he influenced Stephen. No, Hawking has been going down this road for a long time. For a while, Hawking came up with a theory called imaginary time to avoid a beginning, which is another philosophical concept. But even Hawking admitted that in real time, the universe had a beginning. In imaginary time, it didn't. Let me make one other point about Hawking. You know what Hawking is basically saying? By the way, who in here has seen the movie The Matrix? Have you seen the movie The Matrix? Okay. Hawking is saying we're in the Matrix. That's what he's saying, basically. He's saying we're in the Matrix. We don't really know objective reality. It's all a dream. Let me ask you a question. If you were in the Matrix, how could you know you're in the Matrix?
All right, so imaginary time is a concept derived from special relativity and quantum mechanics and is mathematically convenient in connecting quantum mechanics with statistical mechanics. What this means is that it's not an actual thing. Like, time is not an actual substance. Now, if it's what it is with space and time, then space is also not an actual substance. But we don't know what it is. It's one of those same things. It's something, but it's not nothing either. So time is a relative thing due to position of where we are. And that's why you get imagining time as a concept derived from special relativity and quantum mechanics and is mathematically convenient in connecting quantum mechanics with statistical mechanics. That's imaginary time. And I don't think that what you're describing really makes a hell of a lot of sense, because it's not really imaginary in the sense that it's unreal or made up, which is what you're implying that it is. So here's what Stephen Hawking really said, the universe in a nutshell. One might think this means that imaginary numbers are just a mathematical game of having nothing to do with the real world. From the viewpoint of positivist philosophy, however, one cannot determine what is real. All one can do is find which mathematical models describe the universe we live in. It turns out that a mathematical model involving imaginary time predicts not only effects we have already observed, but also effects we have not been able to measure, yet nevertheless believe in for other reasons. So what is real and what is imaginary is the distinction just in our minds. In fact, the names real and imaginary for numbers are just a historical accident, much like the names rational and irrational. The words real and imaginary are picturesque relics of an age when the nature of complex numbers was not properly understood. That is by H.S.M. Coexter. If we dive a little bit farther, you can look in cosmology in the Minkowski space-time model adopted by the theory of relativity. Time can be understood as multiplied by I. Space-time may be represented as a four-dimensional surface or manifold. The equivalent of a distance in space is called an interval. Given an assumption that time is real, an interval D in relativistic space-time is given by the usual formula, but with time negated. This looks like a really fancy formula, and it's D squared equals X squared plus Y squared plus Z squared equal minus T squared, where X and Y and Z are distances along each spatial axis and T a period of time. Mathematically, this is equivalent to writing D squared equals X squared plus Y squared plus Z squared plus, in parentheses, IT squared. In this context, I may be either accepted as a feature of the relationship between space and real time as above, or it may be incorporated into time itself as imaginary time in the equation rewritten in normalized form. So hopefully that's kind of making some sense. I know it's a little harder on a podcast, but yeah. So that's kind of a little tip on imaginary time. It's not actually something that's imaginary. It's just not something that's actually real, but it uses math and other things to describe it. So that's kind of what he is referring to. He, as in Stephen Hawking, not Dr. Turek, who doesn't quite understand the difference between imaginary friends and reality.
You got to get that red pill. You got to get to, what's his name? Leo. Who? Who's the guy you got to get to? Morpheus. You got to get to Morpheus to figure it out, right? I mean, what Hawking is saying is we're in the matrix. Basically, you're in a dream. There is no objective reality. Let me ask you a question. How do you know that you're having a dream? You wake up. And when you wake up, you go, whew, that was just a dream, right? The only way to know you're having a dream is to wake up. The only way to know you're in the matrix is to get out of the matrix. Hawking has to be outside the matrix to know we're in the matrix. See? So philosophically, this just doesn't work. Again, he's standing outside of objective reality to say we're all in the matrix.
Technically, that can be presumed about God, since he's standing outside of time, and you guys all say that he does that. That he works outside of time and space and the universe, and he looks in and operates within, and that if he can't do that, then he's not a God. Well, okay, but that's also not what Stephen Hawking was even saying. He goes, based on this information of relativity and time and imaginary time, we could be in the matrix. It's a theory. A theory. That doesn't mean it's true. But based on other evidence, it suggests that it's a possibility. It's a very unlikely one. The possibility and the, if you look up the, like use a Bayes theorem or something to that extent, it's a very, 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 very far possibility that it's even possible that we're in the matrix. But yeah, you would have to be unplugged and find out. And the reason why we dream is because our brains are still active at night. and while we sleep. So no, Stephen Hawking is not saying that we're in the Matrix. He just was giving an analogy or for instance of what all that information does tell us of other possibilities, of what that kind of, that's what philosophy is, sir. And you're saying that he is asserting this and it's not even true. This is very dangerous that if you're listening to this kind of person and you're not skeptic enough to, or competent enough to discern certain information, when you go and listen to these things, especially in an environment such as a church or auditorium, you're very likely to be subjected to confirmation bias. That or to believe these things without questioning much of it, because quite honestly, you don't have the resources right in front of you. Like I have a computer in front of me, and when things come up, I look it up to see what he's really saying. So without that, it can be kind of, you know, difficult. It's very dangerous. That's why belief is not a very reliable method for determining any actual information or facts or data or anything. I just think we could get rid of belief altogether. I mean, I don't need to believe anything until I know that it exists. Or I know that it's logical to believe in it. Or rational to believe in it and into it to an extent. I'm not going to go, well, cars are real, so I'm going to believe that one day, you know, God is real too because I created cars. It's just my go-to. But I know it's just dumb stuff. Anyways, let's listen to the rest of the segment.
How come he can be outside, but we can't, right? It's like Kant saying, you know, I can see objective reality, but you can't. You can't. There is an objective reality, but you can't know it. Well, why can you know it, but we can't? See? He's outside of his own theory. He's granting himself an exception to his own theory. Okay, that's the grand design by Stephen Hawking. You don't need to be afraid of it.
Okay, well, that's encouraging. Yeah, don't be afraid of the book. Go read it. I mean, seriously, come on, dude. If you're not being objective in your life and you're not discerning and being skeptic, you're going to be so susceptible to scams. It's not even funny. I was going through many reviews on a few things, and I can't believe how people will blame the system or this and that. And I feel like they weren't skeptic enough in the beginning, that they just seem like they're blindsided by everything. And I have a feeling that they go through life just accepting things as it comes forward, because then there's people that have good experiences. And I'm wondering if people that are having good experiences are skeptic enough to know whether or not that is something good or bad. They know how to evaluate a scenario and have an analysis and a little dialogue in their mind going, I could do this. And this would be acceptable. The worst case scenario was this. I'll give it like this, this. If this goes wrong, I'll just walk away. Or I'll give this a shot. If I like it, great. If I don't, I don't have to come back again. You know, that's kind of what it is. And I used to have these stipulations about things all the time. Now, I got friends that go to Coachella every year. And I really considered it this year. However, during the time of Coachella is when I'm also going through my you know, finals and everything. So I was kind of like, yeah, can't really go. So, you know, but one year I might try it. I might just go. And if I like it, awesome. If I don't, great. I can say I did it and I can never go again. That's, you know, how you analyze that. And that's like the worst case scenario. Now the same is also for a job. Great. I can go get this job and, if I like it, great. If I don't, I can leave. You know, granted, there's consequences to that. And that's a whole nother topic that I'll be getting into, which is workplace bullying. But staying in those jobs becomes a thing because it becomes really hard to leave because we become reliant on that money and what it's doing for us outside of work. So again, we have to consider all the options and possibilities and be skeptic enough to know what we can do to work through things. That's what evolution has done for us. So we have developed these abilities to now comprehensively analyze and figure things out a lot differently than we ever were able to before. Our technology is very young, considering the Earth's age. And we don't know that the next population could be robots. Hey, now did I just assert that the population will be robots? Or did I say could be? Have you seen Blade Runner? One thing they don't tell you that they say in the book is that it becomes difficult to determine androids from humans. And androids have technically replaced almost all the life on Earth. And what makes it hard to know, and because the book says this and the movie doesn't, is that no one knows what's who's an android and who's human. That's why when we get to Blade Runner 2049, okay, bit of a spoiler, there is a android basically killing all the other androids. So it's an interesting concept. I love dystopian futures. I love Blade Runner. It's one of my favorite series. 1984. I love these things. It's just so interesting to me. But it's a possibility, right? It could happen. I mean, we're seeing AI take over phones and start communicating with each other in some weird language or something, and we don't even know how they're doing it. I think we underestimate what a soul is and what the mind is, and that if it's mechanics, then it's very possible we can create artificial intelligence that does the same thing because it's mechanics. You're allowing it to think. Again, if that happens, that would disprove a God theory, a creator theory. Because this God who does exist cannot create anything we can, and we can't create anything apparently that it can. It's a logical fallacy. I want to thank you for listening to my episode today, and I hope you enjoyed it. There's a part two to Frank Turek's answering atheism on the Stephen Hawking thing. And if you like it, I'll put another one on here and just let me know in the comments and show your support, obviously. Check out my Facebook page at The Adam Paradox, and you can also check out my Twitter at One Adam Paradox and anchor.fm The Adam Paradox. Thank you for listening. Have a great rest of the week. I will be not posting another video this week, another episode this week, only because I have plans. Yeah, I'm going on a little vacation. So I wish you all the best. Be safe.